Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 346th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, which is brought to you this week by Euphoria on HBO. Euphoria follows a group of high school students as they navigate love and friendships in a world of drugs, sex, trauma, and social media. Critics hail the series as, quote, downright gorgeous, close quote, and, quote, truly remarkable, close quote. Nominated for 6 Emmys, including Outstanding Lead Actress in a Drama Series for Zendaya, Euphoria for your consideration. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most respected and beloved character actors of his generation. Everyone knows and loves him for one thing or another that he's done over the course of his 40 years in the business, be it Broadway's The Band Visit, the indie film Big Night, or TV series such as Wings, Monk, and, most recently, Amazon's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, on which he plays Abe Weissman, the quirky patriarch of a 1950s Jewish family. A man whose mantelpiece includes 4 Emmy Awards, 3 SAG Awards, a Golden Globe Award, and a Tony Award, Tony Shalhoub. Over the course of our conversation, the 66-year-old and I discussed what it was like being one of 10 kids born to Lebanese immigrants, how his restless streak has forced him to take great professional risks that could have resulted in disaster, but instead led to some of his greatest successes, why he has so relished the challenges that he has taken on in recent years, from tackling his first musical to navigating intricately mapped out scenes opposite the lead of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, phenom Rachel Brosnahan, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Tony, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Great to see you. And before we get into your amazing story of your life and career, I want to first ask you about 2 things that are going on in the news, which I think you have an interesting perspective on. First of all, for people who may not know, and I'm going to ask you more about this momentarily, you are of Lebanese descent, and it's been a crazy week there with this Beirut explosion. I just wondered, I hope everyone that you know is okay. What did you make of all of that?
Well, it was shocking, of course, and it's tragic. I have a friend, actually visited Lebanon about 2.5 years ago for the very first time. It was right after we had been shooting in, was shooting Maisel in Paris, and we thought we had a little time off afterwards and thought that would be a good opportunity to go right from there to Beirut and visit. I had never visited the country. I wanted to see the little village where my father was born, and we were able to do that and explore other parts of the country. And we met some great people and took some of them took us around. And so I've been in touch with a couple of those people, and it's devastating. They've just never experienced anything like it. The locals, many of them have, you know, lived through the Civil War, and which was 14, 15 years long, and this seems somehow even more severe and more devastating to them. So we're trying to figure out where the best place is to, you know, we want to donate, we want to help families, we want to help people to see if we can raise money to help rebuild some businesses there, and if and when they can, you know, get things up and running again on that area. But also there's so much, it goes so much deeper when you really start to drill down into the whole economic and political issues there. It's incredibly complicated, and they're going through a massive transitional time. So,
yeah, well, that's one very tough thing that's going on. And then the other, of course, is COVID-19, which I, in prepping for this, learned that actually back in April, in the early days, you and your wife had contracted it. And I haven't spoken with anyone yet who's been through it. So I wanted to just ask you, how rough was it and how are you doing now?
Well, actually, ours hit in mid-March.
Mid-March.
We were kind of, you know, right around the time everybody was seeing the news about Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson and in those sort of early, when everything was still kind of new and unfamiliar. That's about the time we were in New York, and that's about the time we got sick. And so it was a couple of really rough weeks, not as rough as some, and we weren't hospitalized, thank God. But there were moments where we really felt we really needed to take care of each other. The problem is with this kind of a which this kind of a thing is, it's because it's so unfamiliar, you don't know whether you're on the front end of it or the middle or the back end. It's kind of like being in an earthquake. Is it going to get worse? Is it going to get more extreme? Is it ending now? You never have that certainty. And what happened to us was that we were sick for a good solid week. And then one day we'd wake up and we really start to feel better and thought, okay, well, we're out of the woods now. We're on the right trajectory. And then the next day you were down for the count again. And this happened probably 3-4 days in a row. So that was disconcerting. And that kind of made us feel like we were, we were just never going to sort of be free of it.
How does it manifest itself? What were you feeling?
Well, that's another thing. She and I, my wife and I, had different symptoms, some overlapping symptoms, but she had stomach issues, which I didn't have. I had really, really difficult, severe respiratory issues. My bronchioles were so tight, and she didn't have that, although she did have a cough for a while. We both had headaches and fever on and off, and achiness, and especially the tiredness, the kind of all-consuming exhaustion, in the middle, early afternoon, it would just sort of hit you, and you were just kind of, you had to get off your feet. But so that was another baffling situation, because we were comparing notes, but not really, we weren't really aligned on too many things. So we had to sort of, we were trying to treat this thing. We were just kind of making it up as we went along, helping each other. But
Well, thank God. It sounds like you guys are both okay now, or still lingering things.
There's a long, long tail to this thing, which is you hear some people talk about. And every once in a while, you kind of feel like, oh, I'm not feeling 100%. Is this residual COVID, or is it the onset of something else? But now that we're out of the city now, and so we're taking it easy, we're not seeing many people at all, and so we're starting to feel like we're getting it back to 100%.
Well, glad to hear that. And
thanks.
At this point, I will go to where we would normally start, which is just at the basics for people who may not know. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Well, I was born in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and to a large family. I was the second youngest of 10. And my dad, as you can imagine, my mother was busy at home. and my dad was an independent businessman, and he kind of built up this little... he was a salesman, and we were kind of a, I guess you what would you call a blue collar kind of working class family, but he did well, and he was able to kind of make it work with all 12 of us, and so it was a bit of a chaotic childhood, as you can imagine, but it was also kind of great and wild and. Went to public school and high school anyway. And we, my family, my siblings, we still stay close and try to stay close and connected. I go back to Wisconsin a couple of times a year and have, season tickets to Packers, of course.
Nice.
And, it is nice. And, we own some property there and, by the lake. And, so it's, it, it was, I really look at it as a great, it was a great place to grow up.
Yeah. So your father, I believe, was first generation American, your mother second.
My father was an immigrant, so that makes me first generation.
Sorry, right? I got to characterize it.
That's right.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, he came over when he was a boy, having lost his parents in Lebanon when he was very young. So came over with his siblings and they were sponsored by and lived with relatives already living here in Wisconsin. Don't ask me why they were there. So my mother was born in this country, but her folks also came from the Middle East. So that was part of our growing up, the culture.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you know, something like that, being the, as you say yourself, the first generation, and then also being one of 10 kids, how do you think those kinds of things, if at all, shaped the person who you are today?
Very much so. One of my older sisters is an actress. She kind of, I guess you could say, paved the way for me. She's actually on Stranger Things, lives in Atlanta, and she's in Stranger Things, and has been a theater actress for a long, long time. And so, I don't know, I guess I was, the thing about growing up in a big family is you always have a built-in audience, and there's a and there's a kind of it's a kind of thing where you're always sort of entertaining each other, or trying to, let's say. And so there was always a lot of play, that kind of play going on, and a lot of music. And there were some of my siblings, you know, played instruments. And so it was you were never wanting for an audience, some applause. Yeah. And I think that for me, it took hold in a big way.
Now, is the sister who's on Stranger Things the same sister who, I believe, roped you into acting for the first time when you
That's
were
right.
quite young?
Yeah, she was in high school, and I was about six. And they were doing The King and I at at that high school. And I got kind of recruited, you might say, to be one of the kids in that. And so, that's where the hook was set, you might say.
So I guess, it seems like from what I've read, remain involved with acting in the way that kids would through junior high school, go off to, I guess, initially University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, then transfer to University of Southern Maine in Portland, Maine, where I actually once went to summer camp at. Andrew Scoggin is in Portland, or Wayne, Maine. But anyway,
whoa, sure.
Beautiful.
Right.
Yeah. Beautiful part of the country.
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess there, what happened that made theater more of a focus? I think it was something at University of Southern Maine, right?
Right. I have to kind of confess, I went to Maine more or less on a lark. I was kind of, it was my early days of college. I was, you know, kind of floating and exploring and trying to figure out what it was I was going to really focus in on. And I chose Maine for all the wrong reasons. I mean, you know, just like the lamest of reasons, you know, which we can get into later. But I grew up never having had lobster. How's that? That's one of the main things. When I got there, I discovered that this school, this state university, just had a fantastic theater program. And I had done some acting classes at the University of Wisconsin too, of course, but this department was it was really fertile territory. And I really knew quite early on, once having transferred there, that was going to be that I would get the support that I needed to really kind of fulfill that dream, you know. So I did a lot of work at the school, and there was also my senior year in Portland. There was a small local theater. They were kind of, I guess they were semi-professional. I think they had some equity actors and some non-equity. And they were called the Profile Theater. And they were doing what I thought was just, you know, being a student, you go to these outside the university setting and, oh my God, it was really impressive. And I sort of got my foot in the door there, and they, you know, first started, you know, gathering props and running lights and doing walk-ons. And then as the season progressed, I started actually getting, you know, pretty good roles there. Even though I was still, you know, obviously finishing up my senior year, I was working at night at this theater. That theater has since become Portland Stage, which is their regional, you know, kind of local, great theater. But having the kind of the protection and the sort of the comfort zone of the university theater setting and branching out into this theater downtown, that really kind of inspired me. And I applied to the Yale Drama School that spring, and then that next fall I was there.
So in applying to the Yale School of Drama, this one of the, if not the best MFA program there is, that seems like you were making a commitment at that point that this is what you wanted to do with your life. That was going to be a big thing if you got in. How did your folks feel about this path in life that you were now kind of heading down?
Well, you know, I think they were, my older sister, again, having you know, graduated from high school, and then she went to theater school in Pittsburgh. So she kind of paved the way and took a lot of the heat. So I think maybe my experience, you know, maybe the pushback would have been greater had she not hacked through the brush with the machete 10 years before me.
Right.
So I think, and also you got to remember now, my parents, you know, after 10, at this stage and at this age of, in their lives, I mean, they were just pretty much, you know, kind of thrown in the towel. I mean, they were just kind of like, okay, well, the other
one, as long as he's out of the house, yeah.
The other one survived, so right. Let's just, you know, I think they were just tired of the whole thing.
So you are now off in New Haven then for, what is it, 3 years?
It was a three-year master's program, yeah.
And, you know, I grew up in the New Haven area. I know that sometimes Yale rep, you know, it feeds into Yale rep, I believe, the students.
Right. And, it's connected. It's a conservatory situation. Sure.
And, you know, you're pretty close to New York. So you've got, I'm sure, people coming to see you and all of that. So is that where it sort of began to seem real? Like, you know, this is going to be my future. How did those years change you?
Right. It really did. That time at Yale cemented it pretty well. It wasn't until that time that I really started to think that possibly this could be a viable career path, you know. Before my experience at Yale, you know, Meryl Streep had gone through that program, and Sigourney Weaver, and you know, lots of great actors, writers, directors, you know, playwrights, designers. So there, we knew that there were, you know, we were aware that there were people out in the world before, you know, that had gone through the program that were working. And and I'm not talking about movies, and although Meryl was, you know, obviously, she was on that path too, but I'm talking about in theater in New York and regional theater, and that's really what we were being trained for. The emphasis was all on theater, and I imagined that I would have a life in the theater, and I that's what I really wanted, and that's what I really you know, worked toward.
Were you secretly or privately kind of hoping for a screen career as well, or was that not even a priority?
I mean, I guess it wasn't the end game. It wasn't the ultimate goal. The goal was to be, you know, to have a career on any terms, really. But, you know, in the theater, you can, or at least then it was possible, you know, you could carve out a fairly, you know, a decent living. I mean, a modest, but you were, if you were doing what you love, then, you know, that was really the goal, to be doing what you loved with people that you respected and be in an environment where you could constantly grow and evolve as an artist. But I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, did we dream of, you know, I guess so. But, you know, right around that time, it started to become apparent that it didn't have to be an either or situation, and people could move from one to the other. And but, you know, the truth is, when I got out of the drama school, I pretty much did theater for a lot of years before the other.
I was going to say, I mean, rather than moving to New York or L.A. right away, it looks like you were on the road for a good 3 or 4 years just doing theater, right?
I moved from New Haven. I went right up. I was offered a job up at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So I didn't go. The reason I didn't go to New York is because I was broke, and I was, you know, I had student loans, and I didn't want to. I didn't want to just kind of tough it out and wait on tables and that kind of thing. I wanted to continue the work that we had been doing at the school and at the Yale Rep. And I had that opportunity because Robert Brustein, who was the dean of the drama school and the artistic director of the Yale Rep, moved up after his tenure at Yale, moved up to a facility at Harvard and started the American Repertory Theater. So it was a natural transition. I moved to Cambridge, and I was going to just maybe do one season there, but one turned into four. And so I loved it there. And we had, you know, steady work. We were probably working 10 months. Our season was maybe 10 months long. And it was a terrific period of growth. We toured sometimes, you know, in the States and sometimes in Europe. And so we had a lot of great, we had a company of people and a lot of great experiences.
So why then in 1984, you know, did you decide, all right, I am going to try New York, which is the more customary thing, I guess, for a young actor to do. And what happened there in that first year where it seems like on paper, a year after arriving, you're making your Broadway debut. I mean, that's a pretty quick turnaround in The Odd Couple.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but it was actually a matter of months.
One
of those fluky things. Yeah. Well, what happened was I had done, as I said, a number of four seasons at the American Repertory Theater and loved it, loved Boston. But I don't know. I've got something. There's something wrong with me. I've got a, I have a kind of a restless streak in me. I think it's when things are going really well, and I have to sort of change things so that things can go poorly again. You know, I just, it's a terrible habit. I don't know. I don't, not to say that I was becoming complacent in Boston. I don't think, I wouldn't go that far, but I thought I should just try my hand at, you know, I don't know what it was. It was just a kind of a feeling of restlessness. And I also thought, you know, now I'm not quite as broke. I'm not as much in debt for, you know, my loans. And, you know, I had managed to save. We weren't making much in Cambridge, but I managed to save a bit. And I thought I could give New York a shot. And if New York didn't work out after a year or so, I was, you know, I had talked to Brustein, and he was saying, look, you know, you can always come back here if you need to, if you want to, we welcome you back. So I had a little bit of a safety net there, mm-hmm. which was, you know, kind of gave me a little more kind of confidence and possibly less anxiety. So I went to New York, and very quickly, within really just a couple of months, really, I got this Neil Simon play, a pre-Broadway tour of The Female Odd Couple. And let's just, you know, I mean, Neil Simon was not exactly, you know, on my radar. I mean, I had just come out of 3 years of the drama school and 4 years of repertory. We were not doing Neil Simon there. I mean, we were doing not that. And not that I had anything against it. I had no experience there. I just wasn't, you know, it wasn't an arrow in my quiver, really. And so I took a really abrupt and deep dive into the commercial theater from the nonprofit to the commercial theater. And boy, it was fun. God damn it. It was really fun.
I read that, as you're saying, it was sort of going on before it went to Broadway. There were some traveling with it. And in fact,
it was a whole tour, a whole Broadway, all around the country.
I believe somehow, first of all, I know that maybe about a year and change before that, you'd lost your mom, but your father, I think it sounds like from one of the stories I read, he actually really became a true believer only after you arranged a dinner in conjunction with that tour. Can you share what that was?
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, the female Odd Couple starred Rita Moreno and Sally Struthers as Florence and Olive, the counterparts to Felix and Oscar. Mm-hmm. And myself and another terrific actor, Louis J. Stadlin, we played the Costasuela brothers, these Spanish brothers who were the counterparts to the Pigeon Sisters in the original. Anyway, my father was not a big, maybe not such a big TV watcher, but he loved All in the Family. And when he found out that I was doing this play with Sally Struthers, and we had a part of our tour, our national tour, took us to three or four cities in Florida that winter. And my dad at this time was spending winters in Florida, having been burnt out on Wisconsin winters, as you might imagine. And so he came to see the play. I think we were in Fort Lauderdale, I guess. Anyway, I'm not sure that my father really in his whole life went to see that many plays. You could probably count him on one hand. But but he came to the play, and I by this time, the company was pretty close, and I asked Sally if she would do a dinner with my dad, and she just loved the idea, so she very graciously agreed to it, and it was so all of a sudden I was legitimate.
That's great. Well, screen acting now, I guess, enters the picture pretty soon after that because in two ways that are sort of interesting, I want to just ask you about, because two projects that reached audiences in 1986. In terms of film, the first one I want to ask you about is Mike Nichols' directed film, Heartburn. It's starring Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep, and at one point, Tony Shalhoub, but there was a lesson that came through that one, right?
Oh yeah. That was my first, I guess, real kind of experience with the roller coaster of show business. The truth is that, Mike Nichols, obviously, because he had such a long and great relationship with Neil Simon over many, many years, had come to see The Odd Couple when I was still on Broadway. And I was called in to read for this part in Heartburn. So it was thrilling because Mike, when I was just a kid, we were listening to the Nichols and May records, and he was a hero of mine. So anyway, it was a little part, and he hired me to do it, and my stuff was with Meryl Streep, and the thing about this was like before the internet and before all cell phones and all that, but I did tell everyone that I had ever met in my life that I had done this movie directed by Mike and with Meryl and all this, and then, we shot the movie, I think it was like in the summer or fall, and then usually it takes almost a year for a movie to be released. And so a couple months before the movie was going to be released, I was working in Florida on a play down there, a different play, and I got a letter from Mike saying, that my part was just cut out. He was very sorry, but there just wasn't room for this. There was a kind of a running gag through the movie, then they lost it all. And it's very hard to then contact all these people that you've bragged to that you maybe you're not in the movie at all. That was a bit of a hit.
We should say you did work with Mike eventually 10 years later or 12 years, 10 years I think, in Primary Colors, right?
That's right. I did Primary Colors again. So Mike, and he would come and see, he would come. He saw almost everything, I'm sure, on Broadway and off Broadway in New York. So, occasionally our paths would cross. And I did readings for him and with him on other projects. And so then he took pity on me and put me in Primary Colors.
So that was the first film experience. The first TV credited role is interesting, just in it seems like you took another, maybe a little bit of a lesson or a something from this as well. The first is a first credited role was in an hour-long drama called The Equalizer, and your guy that you played was not credited with a name. He was listed in the credits as terrorist. And I think that you vowed after that that there was not going to be a second role like that, right? I mean, it was a...
Yeah. This was, let's say, I'm trying to like figure out, this is the timeline on this. I'm going to guess it was like 80. Oh, I guess it must have been 86.
It was 86. 1986, yeah, it was.
Because I was... Mm-hmm. I the only reason I know that is because I in this episode, I had a mustache, and it was the mustache that I was, you know, had grown for the play. So, and I couldn't shave it. So, yeah, you know, it was a really great experience. I mean, it was my first foray into episodic and shooting fast. And I worked with really good director and Edward Woodward, who was the guy who played the lead in the series. He was fantastic and supportive. But I just realized, you know, that I didn't want to get kind of pigeonholed into that part, given my ethnicity and all that. And so I tried to just sort of do other things and sidestep mm-hmm. those roles.
Well, you were back on Broadway for the Heidi Chronicles 89 to 90 as a replacement this time. And is that where you met your wife, or was that a different version of Heidi Chronicles?
No, that's where I met Brooke.
Yeah. And then I guess not long after that, there was some kind of a decision to move to LA, move out west. What precipitated that?
Again, you know, that thing of I was really feeling like I had gotten quite a toehold there in New York. I was feeling comfortable going into casting offices. I was getting some TV stuff, some film stuff, and still doing a ton of theater. And so I was feeling pretty good. So of course I had to just break it right off. And I don't know. There's just something wrong with me. I thought, well, this is all going too well. I've got to go. I got to go where, I can be a big failure. So, I it was more of a lark. I just thought, well, I'll give LA a shot. And if it doesn't work out, I suppose I'll come back to New York. And I just really don't have a better story.
No, I mean, that's interesting. And I think if we want to further infuriate any young actors who are listening and struggling, because you said, you know, when you moved to New York, it was just months before you got your first Broadway role. You moved to LA. What was your first audition?
Oh, I had a lot of auditions in LA, but the problem was it was a very different landscape in terms of the business than I had gotten used to in New York. I was with a good agency that was, you know, had offices in both in New York and in LA. So they were sending me up a lot. I had a little bit of, you know, screen credit stuff. I had some Broadway credits. I had some television film stuff, but I don't know. I was struggling in LA. I was getting auditions, but I was not getting callbacks. Whereas in New York, I was at least getting almost pretty regularly getting callbacks. If I didn't get the job, I probably got two or three callbacks and, you know, sabotaged myself somehow. But anyway.
Well, the reason I asked, though, was just that somebody misreported in an earlier piece, but I had read that Wings initially as a guest part, but that was one of the very first things that you went out for.
Oh boy, no, not accurate. Accurate. No, because I was getting really discouraged because I'll tell you, I can give you the kind of timeline. I moved out from New York to LA around the time of my birthday, which is early October. Mm-hmm. And I was auditioning a lot. I just was not getting any traction in Los Angeles. And I was second guessing, you know, my decision. And I was doing a play in a really tiny theater that I had done in New York to some success off Broadway. And in LA, it was just, it was not happening. It was a New York play, not an LA play. So it was, Wings was probably, I didn't audition for Wings until January. So there was a number of months there where I was going out, you know, several times a week for sitcoms, for film, for whatever. And just, I was just hitting a wall, hitting a
Do you remember, were there any like that you really particularly wanted or that went on to become something that you did not get?
Oh, sure. Many. This was actually when I was still in New York. I auditioned for Seinfeld for Jason Alexander's part.
Really?
I mean, there were many things that I just would have given my right arm to do, but I was not getting anywhere in LA. I almost feel like there was possibly like too much theater on my resume where they were, theater guy. I just wasn't finding the groove. But then I got the Wings, the audition for just that one episode of Wings. And luckily the producers, and I think the casting director on that show, they were real theater, you know, aficionados. And they when they came to New York, they saw a lot of theater, you know, all the time. I found this out later. So I think they had seen me in a play, and they had, I think by this time, Quick Change, this movie, one of my first movies that I did with Bill Murray in New York, that had come out. And so there was, these guys were just more familiar with, even though I was incredibly unknown.
Well, it was a theatrical part too, right? I mean, this guy, Antonio Scarpacci, very fiery taxi driver.
Well, actually, in the first episode, Antonio was not, his name was Antonio, but he was actually like a restaurant. He was a waiter or something, or waiter at an Italian restaurant. And he was pretty fiery and volatile. I don't know, something just happened and they kind of unleashed me. The director unleashed me. And then they asked me to come back later a few months later as a recurring.
And that's amazing. That was your first extended TV project, 91 to 97, 144 episodes you did. And I guess there were still opportunities in the schedule to do other things, because it looks like maybe just a year into the show, you were on Broadway getting your first, en route to your first Tony nomination with Conversations with My Father.
Well, that was the beauty of that sitcom schedule. And this was the first sitcom I'd ever done. But, you know, it basically was 7 months of shooting and then a 5 month hiatus period. And they let me out early that year to go do, Wings let me out early to go back to New York to do Conversations. And then on those in other years, later years of Wings, I would, you know, I did Big Night, one of those hiatus periods with Stanley Tucci. And so I was able to kind of keep doing other things while, because of that sitcom schedule was so great.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Big Night, and of course I've got to ask you about that. But before, there were some other either notable roles, just interesting film work. The doctor of one of the guys in Longtime Companion, 1990, the first Hollywood movie to deal with AIDS. That then 91, you're working with the Coen brothers for the first time as this kind of manic Jewish producer in Barton Fink. And you would get back to that with them years later again with The Man Who Wasn't There. But so there's these early kind of smallish film roles, but then a role that you've described, let me read back a quote to you, actually. You said that the part in Big Night as Primo, one of these two Italian immigrant brothers who have very different philosophies about how to run their restaurant in 1950s New Jersey, you have called this film, quote, such a turning point for me. I kind of look at things as sort of pre-Big Night and post-Big Night. I felt like that was maybe the most fortunate thing that had ever happened to me, close quote. So can you talk about why you feel that way?
Well, for so many reasons. I mean, look, I had done a play with Stanley a number of years while I was still living in New York. We were both living in New York. And so we were friends. And, you know, Big Night was that Primo was a dream role. I mean, it really was. And to work on this kind of super original material, to have all of the support of the film production company, it was, you know, Stanley was very, you know, his standards are so high, and he really elevates everyone's game. And I had never had that kind of experience before, where you're working with friends, where everyone's sort of like, we're all peers. He and Campbell Scott were directing it. A lot of the actors in it were, you know, people who I'd worked with in the theater or knew from the theater. The material really hit home because it's about that balance. It's a story about the balance between art and commerce, and that the kind of tug of war there. And we were all feeling that as young actors. How do we hold on to our integrity and not starve to death? And you know what I mean? And how many times and how many ways can you feel like you're selling out before you hit a point of diminishing returns? And then you're sort of redefined forever, you know? So all of those, the themes of the movie, the kind of the period, I love that period. To be working in that, you know, in the 1950s again, which is, you know, when I was a kid and watching, you know, my parents and my, it's kind of like how I feel about Maisel, you know, it's like reliving my childhood in a strange way. So for many, many reasons, that movie and the movie struck a chord with so many people. Yeah. And still does. It has long, long legs, that picture.
Very, very passionate following. And I just want to note two of the other people, aside from you and Stanley, two other people in there. One of them was, a hero of yours, Ian Holm, who just recently passed away. And then another one, just for trivia buffs, in the starch scene is the same actress who now plays your in-law, Mrs. Joel Maisel's mother, Caroline Aaron. Yeah. Yes. So there's a long connection there. But after Big Night, I don't know if it was as a result of Big Night or it was just happening anyway, but just to zoom through a few other things en route to some topics, you played the pawn shop owner who turns out to be an alien in Men in Black. You played the boss lawyer with John Travolta in A Civil Action, which I remember very fondly. And then there's another, I guess, maybe kind of tough lesson that people can maybe learn something from who are listening about what you thought was going to be the next big series. And I'm not talking about Monk. I'm talking about a show that was called Stark Raving Mad, and it seemed to have all the pieces, right?
Yes, it was a NBC half hour multicam sitcom with Neil Patrick Harris, and it was Steve Levitan, who then later went on to do Just Shoot Me and Modern Family, and a lot of other writers and producers that came off of Wings. On Wings, Steve was just a junior writer, and we were given this amazing time slot. I think it was like that must see, you know, NBC yeah. Thursday night dream slot. And we did one season. I think we did 20 or so, 21 episodes. I think they aired 19. But for some reason, which, you know, was way above my pay grade, they chose not to renew the show. So even though it had won like the People's Choice Award that year for Best New Comedy, and so that was a bit of a, that was a bite, because I guess it was the first time that I really felt, aside from the fact that we were just having a blast doing it and we were proud of it, and I love working with Neil and all those people, Eddie McClintock, it was the first time where I really felt like being fired. You know, I mean, there's just no other way to frame that. You know, it's your it was me and Neil and in the leading parts. And
and they never gave a real ex, because it wasn't like nobody was watching, right? It was a,
you know, it had something to do with, I don't know, who knows. We came right after Frasier, which was a monster hit, and right before, I think, ER, right? Something like that. And maybe the numbers dropped in the middle there. I don't know. It's all those TV things that I don't really care to know about.
Well, there's something on paper that looked like it should have worked on paper and didn't. And then conversely, you've got a show developed by ABC that's with a script that's kicking around forever, winds up at Basic Cable USA Network, and it happens to be called Monk, and winds up having 8 amazing seasons, Golden Globe, 3 Emmys for your performance as this guy who, following the unsolved killing of his wife, becomes a bit OCD, more than a bit. I guess I just wonder, when that crossed your radar for the first time, would you ever have imagined it would have such a life?
No, not really. No. I mean, you never know with these things. It's so much about the timing, what the world is kind of, what the audiences, viewers have an appetite for, how, what level of familiarity is there in it, and what level of novelty is there to be seen as something kind of new and interesting, but not too weird and strange. And so there's so many moving parts and so many unknowns. I think one of the things that, other than the, really excellent writing and great creative team, USA was kind of rebranding itself at that time. They were moving into original series. They didn't have, I think they just had 2 or 3 of that. They had I think, a bit of a changing of the guard just before that. And because they had so few original series, they were able to focus on them and nurture them and give them a lot of care and attention and figure out good ways to grow, to market it and to grow the brand. And so I felt like I was just in the right place at the right time, because that was not, a network that I was super familiar with, or wasn't like a lot of actors were clamoring to be on that network at that time. But that kind of ended up working in our favor, I think. And I remember too, just as worth mentioning, that this was at a time when, cable was, obviously starting to really take hold, but I think, I'm pretty sure it was USA had this, they took a gamble and they had this idea to premiere the show in the summer. And nobody was doing that then. Summer was a time for reruns. People were on vacation. Nobody was home watching. People waited till the fall to the lineup of the new shows, blah, blah, or the new seasons. And they just thought, no, we're not going to deal with all of that competition. We're going to just sneak it in here when no one's looking and sure enough, the timing.
Yeah.
Who knows if a year prior to that, it might have not have kind of worked, but.
Interesting.
And then interestingly, I think a lot of other, this became a time when people were, DVR. And so you could, it wasn't just, must-see viewing at this moment kind of stuff. So it was, we were lucky. And then other networks and other shows started to premiere in the summer. And then it just became, the schedules thing just changed.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, so you had previously, obviously, as we've said, you'd done Wings, which was a long run with a lot of episodes, but you were a supporting part. You had done Stark Raving Mad, but that didn't last very long, 22 episodes. So here's the first time where you are carrying a show over an extended period of time, 16 hour-long episodes per season, over 8 seasons. Is that overwhelming? How do you keep it from getting old? Was it just a matter of, as you say, the writing, or are there other And I just, before you answer, I want to read back a quote from Andy Breckman, who was the co-creator and EP, who once said, quote, "Writing for Tony Shalhoub's voice is like writing for Bob Newhart. It's all about pacing, timing, the pauses. We throw different pitches at the plate to see if he can hit it. It's like a game for us." We did an episode where he went through all five stages of grief in 30 seconds, close quote. So, I mean, this is not the kind of show where you could phone it in at any time. So just, I guess, to come back to the question, that's quite a long run to be carrying a show, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, there are others who do more episodes per year for many more years, but it was challenging. We were very, very lucky because we had an unusual schedule that other shows, other hour-longs did not have. And I'm not sure if that's changed and others have now taken on that pattern. But at the time, we were the only ones. We were doing, you mentioned, 16 episodes a year, and that's right. But we didn't do them all in a row. We did it like two mini seasons. So we started in the spring in March, let's say, and we'd shoot nine. And then we had 2 months off. We had a two-month hiatus in the summer, which was great because my kids were out of school. I could spend time with, you know, the family. We aired those nine episodes during that hiatus in the summer. And then once those episodes were kind of just about to be burned off, around Labor Day, we would come back and we would regroup the crew, you know, the crew and everybody would come back and we'd shoot the remaining seven episodes. And then we were, that was 2.5 months. So that would be done by Thanksgiving, let's say. So we had a four-month hiatus in the winter and a two-month hiatus in the summer. And it, when I told other actors that I knew who were doing it, that we had the schedule, I made a lot of enemies. I mean, it was just one of those fluky, crazy things. But in a sense, it was good. The network kind of liked it because the audience then, they never had to go too many months without new stuff, right? Do episodes. So, and they only had a shorter waiting period. You know, by breaking it up, you kind of created a little bit of an anticipation, you know, well, what's going to happen in the last half of the season sort of a thing. So, that's what made it doable. And I didn't kill myself because had I done, you know, 16 in a row, that would have been daunting and more fortunate.
Well, and it does seem like one of the great pairings of actor and part, because I think I can't imagine an actor doing that part who didn't have the kind of theatrical experience that you did, because this guy with all the business and the physical humor, which I know you've said is kind of almost modeled on Chaplin. And then the backstory of, I think in your mind, you had said maybe he had been a virgin. I think there's a lot of stuff there that it's interesting, but
I'm not sure Andy Breckman agreed with that, but that's okay.
Well, after those 8 years of Monk, you went back to Broadway for the first time in 17 years. And within a period of, I think, 6 or 7 years, just went on a run that is incredible. I was only lucky enough to see about half of these, but I just want to mention Lend Me a Tenor in 2010, then Golden Boy 2012 to 2013, where you get your second Tony nomination. Then the first time I got to see you on Broadway, and you were then nice enough to come do our roundtable that I moderated with just the best actors of the year, including you, playing Mosshart's father, playing middle-aged Mosshart, and then playing Mosshart's mentor, George S. Kaufman, all with rapid changes on a circular set that was rotating, different accents for each guy, different, completely different wardrobes. It was really incredible.
Act one,
at Lincoln Center. Then The Price, a smaller part, but an excellent show, 2017. And then what I have to ask you about, of course, is The Band's Visit, which you, just for anyone who hasn't had the chance to see it, you are playing this sort of very straight-laced, turns out to be grieving conductor of a Arab band.
An Egyptian band, police orchestra, yes.
Police orchestra that winds up stuck in a small Israeli town in 1996. This had originally been a film. Now it's going to the theater as a musical. You are not someone who I believe had done musicals before. No, so how did this even... well, so how did this even come about?
You know, I fought it like crazy. I just kept telling them they were misguided, and I gave them lists of other actors that they really should have, you know, should look at. And you know, it was just one of those things where I couldn't talk them out of it. And I thought, you know, I really think it was just I need to go into some uncharted waters here and possibly fall flat on my face. And maybe that's okay. Maybe it's time in my life for that. But I got so much support from the cast, from the music director, from the composer, the director, the writer. I mean, they were, you know, they really coddled me and you know, they took good care of me and didn't let me jump off the Brooklyn Bridge. And I'm so glad I did it, because it was terrifying, and you know, it was humbling, and it all turned out great.
Well, and what's just kind of interesting, noteworthy about it, among other things, is that I can't think of any character more different from, let's say, Monk. This is a guy who is the stiffest, most kind of no business, right? I mean, he's very still, a stillness.
Yeah. Thing, yeah.
Was that itself challenging for a guy who's done a lot of more theatrical stuff?
It was, actually. It was. And I really credit David Cromer, the director, who, you know, really had to sit on me and kind of, because my impulse is to come up with clever shtick and see if I can get a laugh here and, you know, ingratiate myself to the audience and all that good stuff. And David was really, you know, really firm and very articulate too about how, you know, this guy and this material just didn't warrant that. And it didn't require it, because it had to do with it sort of spoke for itself. And it was really all about the stillness of this guy and the fact that he is quite shut down and shut off from his own, you know, from his own emotions, because he's been through so much pain and he's guarded. So it was a matter of restraining, exercising enormous restraint not to go for those laughs. Yeah.
Well, the timing also is just kind of interesting, because I believe it was almost in between the transition from off-Broadway, where it was a phenomenon, to Broadway, where it was a phenomenon, that we had our 2016 presidential election, which in a way, I wonder if you think changed the viewer experience of seeing this production.
Absolutely. We were actually, that election night was, we were in tech for the off-Broadway run of that. We were down at the Atlantic Theater on 20th Street, and, these tech days are, as many know, are incredibly long. You know, you're just doing, you know, cue to cue lights and sound, and they're grueling days, because they're so long. And a musical like this, you off Broadway would normally take two or three tech days, and so after we were released, we all went to this pub around the corner to get some food and watch the results. And boy, it was devastating. And the next day when we came in to do the play, I think it was the dress rehearsal or the first preview, it was all of a sudden felt like a different play because of what was out there. And I think, although I have to say, I've talked to other friends and colleagues who were in plays, other plays at that time, and I think everybody felt that way. Mm-hmm. It was such a seismic, you know, shift. But in some ways, doing a play, especially our play, The Band's Visit, there was some kind of catharsis to it all, too. Mm. You know, and it brought us all together and in a really good, warm way.
Yeah. Well, I believe it's in the middle of the, again, in the middle of the run of doing one incarnation or the other of The Band's Visit, that you first hear about this script called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, or the pilot script. And I guess I wonder what your initial reaction was, and correct me if I have this part wrong, but I mean, I believe your family would be of Arab descent. You were raised Christian, and now you're being asked to play the patriarch of a Jewish family from 1950s New York in a pilot where the guy doesn't even have that much going on. So what did you respond to? Obviously, he later does have much going on, but what was the initial thing that made you say this is worth being part of?
Well, again, a great period for me. I love the 50s, the 40s. I love that. I think, you know, you're right. The part of Abe in the pilot is pretty small. It's pretty contained. But I responded really to the tone of it, to the writing, the rhythm of it, the intelligence of it, and also the fact that the main character, Midge, was around the age that I have two daughters, and so she's kind of right in between their ages. And I kind of keyed into that relationship there. But it's certainly not the first time that I've played a Jewish character played three in Act One.
But, that's right. And Barton Fink.
And Barton Fink.
Man Who Was, yeah.
And the Man Who Wasn't There. And
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
So these elements were you know, really were stood out for me. And then I got a phone conversation with Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. I had not met them before, but obviously was a fan of their work. And I said, look, I just like to know, you know, what do you see for Abe, you know, moving forward? Obviously, there's only so much story you can tell in a pilot, and it's not the lead part, so you got to take care of that story. And they assured me that, you know, all of these characters were going to be served very, very well over time, and they gave me an inkling of where this was going to go. And I think I really responded to, I trusted that assurance. And also like the fact that, you know, it's about family, and it's about show business. And, you know, that's a great arena for me. And
it was shooting in New York, right?
and I had just moved to New York, and it was shooting in New York. And oh my God, how much better. And it's one of those things that, you know, just comes along, and you just feel like, well, got very lucky again.
So, you know, last few minutes here, I just got to ask you about how was that for a while there? You're juggling both The Band's Visit and Maisel for quite a while. How did you make that work? And we should also just really quickly, I want to note that in the end, there were Tonys for Best Musical for The Band's Visit, for Katrina Lenk, who also, we should say, appears in Maisel as the fortune teller, and of course for you. But just how did you juggle that schedule?
You know, they helped me. Everyone helped me. It just kind of timed out. I think I did the pilot of Maisel. That wasn't a very long time commitment. We had to wait to see if Amazon was going to pick it up. And then I did the off-Broadway. I did the off-Broadway version of Band's Visit. Then there was a long period between the off-Broadway and Broadway run, because they had to get investors and they had to find the right theater. And while that 6-month period was happening, I was doing the first season of Maisel. And then that season ended and I went into the Broadway run. And then that, it just was the best, you know, the best possible good fortune. I think I had to leave the Band's Visit early, though, to start season two. The Broadway run was going, and I had to bail out before I really would have liked to, because we had to start and go to Paris, which was torture.
Poor guy, yeah.
It was torture. Yeah.
Well, and just as you grew into playing this guy, who, you know, Columbia mathematics professor initially, and just a finicky, interesting character. Can you talk about, you've said he kind of reminded you of your own dad.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. My dad was very pragmatic and was, like Abe, a super math brain, you know. He was a numbers guy. And unlike my mom was the opposite. She couldn't care not one whit about that stuff. And my mother was much more, you know, focused on, you know, she was so well-read and she loved film and she loved theater too. And she, you know, she was that other spirit. But I did connect Abe to my own father. And again, because I grew up, I was very young, you know, during that period. And I can sort of visualize him in those kinds of, well, him and his cronies, you know, in those cars, in those clothes, in those hats, you know. So it was a really familiar landscape for me.
And as promised to you, I guess, by the Paladinos, you know, it wasn't just Midge whose story has evolved over the course of this. Your character in season one, I think it may be, to sum it up essentially, is a guy whose world is turned upside down. His daughter is not who he thought she was, becoming both a divorcee and a comic. Season two, his own marriage is now on the rocks, and he winds up quitting his job. Season three, he's the guy who's now getting in touch with his younger self. I guess I just wonder what you've made of the arc of this character.
Well, I'm so trusting. I trust the writers, and I didn't know any of this, of course, going into any one season where Abe was going to go. But I just, you know, I love that about these writers. It's so rare in a TV show you get to go through all these changes. You know, oftentimes if you're on series television, your character serves a certain, you know, has a certain voice, serves a certain function in the story, and that very often does not change much, which can be frustrating for actors, where you kind of, you know, yes, you have job security, but you get sort of stuck playing two or three colors continually. And so that can be frustrating. Whereas with these writers, man, it's curveball after curveball. And, you know, you're never on sure footing. It makes it really challenging and keeps it, you know, keeps it alive.
Well, I have to confess, it is my favorite show on television. I can't get enough of it. And I think maybe I can leave you with this question, which is that you're so amazing in this. Rachel Brosnahan is off the charts. She's great. And I wonder, of the scenes that you two have had together, is there one that you've most enjoyed playing as you look back? And you've had a lot of great moments together.
She's a rare bird. And, so versatile and so incredibly, just so hardworking. I mean, her task is just monumental. I've had a lot of really great fun scenes with her, but one that stands out the most is the scene in the Catskills, the first time Abe sees her on stage performing her stand-up and becomes aware that she's doing this. And then it dawns on him that this is what she has been doing when she was going out at night for all that time in season one and two. She is so phenomenal in that routine. When she starts a routine, becomes aware of Abe, becomes aware of me, and then can't stop, has this compulsion to keep going and digging her hole, you know, deeper and deeper. And I've said this before, and I bears repeating. This, her performance will be studied by acting students in the future. I mean, it is so complex what she is doing.
And oh, yeah.
I just love doing that because I got to see take after take, and I got a lot of takes on my side when they're on me. And it was challenging too, because again, this goes back to everything goes back to directors sitting on me, really. Only for 40 years though. Much like the band's visit. I mean, Amy was directing that one, I think. And she just said, look, you know, you don't even need to. I think Abe just can't react. He is just so stunned and stymied. And in a way, it allowed me to just kind of freeze up. And by doing that, all of this enormous internal flush kind of starts to boil, you know, this, all your guts, you know, start to boil up, and just sort of comes into your chest and into your heart and into your brain and into your eyeballs. And it's completely internal, and yet it's enough for the camera.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that was really, really a game changer for me in terms of understanding this guy and the dynamics, understanding what his kind of role, how he saw himself as a father and as a man.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrific. And, I can't thank you enough for doing this. I love what you guys are doing on that show, and I hope you do it forever. And
me too.
And yeah, thank you for doing this.
Great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free and leave us a rating on iTunes or your podcast app, as well as on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/awardschatter. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/the race. Until next time, thanks for joining us.